Chapter 8. Early in the month of September, 1874, word was received at Fort McPherson that General Sheridan and a party of friends were coming to the post to have a grand hunt in the vicinity. They further proposed to explore the country from Fort McPherson to Fort Hays in Kansas. They arrived in a special car at North Platte, 18 miles distant, on the morning of September 22. In the party besides General Sheridan were James Gordon Bennett, of the New York Herald, Leonard Lawrence Jerome, Carol Livingston, Major J.G. Hexter, General Fitzhugh, General H.E. Davies, Captain M. Edward Rogers, Colonel J. Schuyler Crosby, Samuel Johnson, General Anson Stager, of the Western Union, Charles Wilson, editor of the Chicago Journal, Quartermaster General Rutter, and Dr. Ashe, of General Sheridan's staff. They were met at the station by General Emory and Major Brown, with a cavalry company, as escort and a sufficient number of vehicles to carry the distinguished visitors and their baggage. At the fort they found the garrison, under the command of General Carr, on parade awaiting their arrival. A train of 16 wagons was provided to carry the baggage, supplies and forage for the hunting trip. Besides these there were 3 or 4 horse ambulances, in which the guns were carried, and in which members of the party might ride when they became weary of the saddle. I accompanied the expedition at the request of General Sheridan. He introduced me to everybody, and gave me a good send-off. As it was a high-toned outfit I was to accompany, I determined to put on a little style myself. I dressed in a new suit of light buckskin, trimmed along the seams with fringe of the same material. I put on a crimson shirt, elaborately decorated on the bosom, and selected a big sombrero for my head. Then, mounting a showy horse which was a gallant stepper, I rode down to the fort, rifle in hand. The expedition was soon underway. First in line rode General Sheridan, followed by his guests, then the orderlies. Then came the ambulances, in one of which were carried 5 greyhounds, brought along to coarse antelopes and rabbits. With the ambulance marched a pair of Indian ponies belonging to Lieutenant Hayes, captured during an Indian fight. These were harnessed to a light wagon, which General Sheridan occasionally used. These little animals, 13 hands high, showed more vigor and endurance than any we brought with us. During our first night in camp, the members of the party asked me hundreds of questions about buffaloes and buffalo hunting. The entire evening was spent in talk about buffaloes, together with stories of the plains, the chase, and the war, which was then fresh in the minds of all of us. We closed the evening by christening the camp, Camp Brown, in honor of the gallant officer, who was in command of the escort. We breakfasted it for the next morning and at 6 we were in the saddle. Everyone was eager to see the buffaloes, which I had promised would be met with during the day. After a march of 5 miles the advance guard, which I commanded, sighted 6 of these animals grazing about 2 miles away. Acting upon my suggestion, Lawrence Jerome, Livingston, Hexter, Fitzhugh, Rogers, and Crosby, with myself as guide, rode through a convenient canyon to a point beyond the herd, and to windward of them, the rest of the party made a detour of nearly 5 miles, keeping behind the crest of a hill. We charged down on the buffaloes at full gallop, and just then the other party emerged from their concealment, and witnessed the exciting chase. The buffaloes started away in a line, single file. Fitzhugh, after a lively gallop, led us all. Soon he came alongside the rear buffalo, at which he fired. The animal faltered, and with another shot Fitzhugh brought him to the ground. Crosby dashed past and leveled another of the herd, while Livingston dropped a third. Those who were not directly engaged in the hunt now came up and congratulated the buffalo killers. Fitzhugh was hailed as the winner of the Buffalo Cup. There was general sympathy for Hexter, whose horse had fallen and rolled over him, thus putting him out of the race. The hunt being over, the column moved forward through a prairie dog town, several miles in extent. These animals are found throughout the plains, living together in a sort of society. Their numberless burrows in their towns join each other, and the greatest care is necessary in riding among them, since their ground is so undermined as easily to give way under the weight of a horse. Around the entrance to each burrow earth is piled to the height of at least a foot. On these little elevations the prairie dogs sit on their haunches, chattering to each other and observing whatever passes on the plains. They will permit a person to approach very closely, but when they have viewed him they dive into their holes with wonderful celerity. They are difficult to kill. If it they usually succeed in getting underground before they can be recovered. Rattlesnakes and little owls are found in great numbers in the prairie dog towns, living in the same burrows. We killed and cooked a few of the prairie dogs, and found them very palatable. A short distance beyond the prairie dog town we found a settlement of 5 white men. They proved to be the 2 Clifford brothers, Arthur Ruff, Dick Seymour, and John Nelson. To the last I have already referred. Each of these men had a squaw for a wife and numerous half-breed children. They lived in tents of buffalo skins. They owned a herd of horses and a few cattle, and had cultivated a small piece of land. Their principal occupation was hunting, and they had numbers of buffalo hides, which they had tanned in the Indian fashion. Upon reaching Pleasant Valley on Medicine Creek, the party divided into 2 detachments, one hunting along the bank of the creek for elk and deer, the other remaining with the main body of the escort. The elk hunters met with no success whatever, but the others found plenty of buffaloes and nearly everybody killed one, before the day was done. Lawrence Jerome made an excellent shot. He was riding in an ambulance, and killed a buffalo that attempted to cross the line of march. Upon crossing the Republican River on the morning of the 26th, we came upon an immense number of buffaloes scattered over the country in every direction. All had an opportunity to hunt. The wagons and troops moved slowly along toward the next camp, while the hunters rode off in 2s and 3s. Each hunter was rewarded with abundant success. Lawrence Jerome met with the only mishap. He was riding Buckskin Joe, which I had lent him, and, dismounting to get a steady shot, thoughtlessly let go of the bridle. The horse decided to do a little hunting on his own account. When last seen that day he was ahead of the buffaloes, and gaining, while his late rider was left to his own reflections. 3 days later Joe, saddled and bridled, turned up at Fort McPherson. We pitched our camp for the night in a charming spot on the bank of Beaver Creek. The game was so abundant that we remained there the next day. This stopping place was called Camp Cody, in honor of the reader's humble servant. The next day was spent in hunting jackrabbits, coyotes, elk, antelope, and wild turkeys. That we had a splendid dinner may be seen from the following bill of fare. Soup. Buffalo tail. Fish. Broiled cisco, fried dace. Entrees. Salmi of prairie dog, stewed rabbit, filet of buffalo au champignons. Vegetables. Sweet potatoes, mashed potatoes, green peas. Dessert. Tapioca pudding. Wines. Champagne frapp, champagne au naturel, claret, whiskey, brandy, ale. Coffee. I considered this a fairly good meal for a hunting party. Everybody did justice to it. The excursionists reached Fort Hays on the morning of October 2nd. There we pitched our tent for the last time. That same afternoon General Sheridan and his guests took the train for the east. They expressed themselves as highly pleased with the hunt, as well as with the way they had been guided and escorted. General Davies afterward wrote the story of this hunt in a volume of 68 pages, called 10 Days on the Plains. In this chapter I have taken the liberty of condensing frequently from this volume, and in some cases have used the general's exact language. I ought to insert several lines of quotations marks, to be pretty generally distributed through the foregoing account. After the departure of General Sheridan's party we returned to Fort McPherson, and found General Carr about to start on a 20-day scout. His object was more to take some friends on a hunt than to look for Indians. His guests were a couple of Englishmen and Mr. McCarthy of New York, the latter a relative of General Emory. The command consisted of 3 companies of the 5th Cavalry, 1 company of Pawnee Scouts, and 25 wagons. Of course I was called to accompany the expedition. One day, after we had been out for some little time, I arranged with Major North to play a joke on Mr. McCarthy. I took him out on a hunt about 8 miles from the camp, informing Major North about what time we should reach there. he had agreed that he would appear in the vicinity with his Indians, who were to throw their blankets around them and come dashing down upon us, firing and whooping in the true Indian style. This program was faithfully carried out. I had been talking about Indians to McCarthy, and he had become considerably excited, when just as we turned a bend in the creek we saw a band of them not half a mile away. They instantly started after us on the gallop, yelling and shooting. "McCarthy," said I, "shall we run or fight?" He did not wait to reply. Wheeling his horse, he started at full speed down the creek. He lost his gun and dropped his hat, but never once did he look back, to see if he were pursued. I tried to stop him by shouting that the Indians were Pawnees and our friends. He did not hear me, but kept straight on, never stopping his horse till he reached the camp. I knew he would tell General Carr that the Indians had jumped him, and that the general would at once start out with troops. So as soon as the Pawnees rode up, I told them to remain there while I rode after my friend. When I had reached camp, he had given the alarm, and the general had ordered out two companies of cavalry to go in pursuit of the Indians. I told the general the Indians were only Pawnees, and that a joke had been put up on McCarthy. I neglected to tell him who had put up the joke. He was fond of a joke himself, and did not get very angry. I had picked up McCarthy's hat, which I returned to him. It was some time before it was discovered who was at the bottom of the affair. It was while I was stationed at Fort McPherson, where Brevet Major General W.H. Emery was in command, that I acted as guide for Lord Flynn, an English nobleman, who had come over for a hunt on the plains. I had been recommended to him by General Sheridan. Flynn had served in India with the British Army. He was a fine sportsman and a splendid shot, and secured many heads and skins while he was with me. Money meant little to him. He insisted on paying all the bills, spending his money lavishly on both officers and men, when he was at the post. Once, when we ran out of liquid refreshments while on the hunt, we rode 30 miles to a saloon, only to find it closed. Lord Flynn inquired the price of the place, found it to be $500 and bought it. When we left, after having had all we needed to drink, he gave it, house, bar, stock, and all, to George Dillard, who had come along with the party, as a sort of official bartender. Sir George Watts Garland also made the hunt with us. He was an excellent hunter and a thorough gentleman, but he lacked the personality that made Lord Flynn one of the most popular visitors who ever came to the post. Early in January, 1872, General Forsyth and Dr. Ashe, of General Sheridan's staff, came to Fort McPherson to make preparations for a grand buffalo hunt to be conducted for the Grand Duke Alexis. General Sheridan was desirous of giving the Russian nobleman the hunt of his life. He wanted everything ready when the Grand Duke arrived, so that he need lose no time at the post. By way of giving their distinguished guest a real taste of the plains, the two officers asked me to visit the camp of the Sioux chief, Spotted Tail, and ask him to bring 100 of his warriors to the spot on Red Willow Creek, which, at my suggestion, had been selected as the Grand Duke's camp. Spotted Tail had permission from the government to hunt buffalo, a privilege that could not be granted to Indians indiscriminately, as it involved the right to carry and use firearms. You couldn't always be sure just what kind of game an Indian might select when you gave him a rifle. It might be buffalo, or it might be a white man. But Spotted Tail was safe and sane. Hence the trust that was reposed in him. Forsyth and Ashe, after accompanying me to the site I had found for the camp, returned to the post, while I set out to confer with Mr. Spotted Tail. The weather was very cold, and the journey was by no means a delightful one. I was obliged to camp out with only my saddle blankets to protect me from the weather, and only my vigilance to protect me from the Indians. Spotted Tail himself was friendly, but some of his young men were decidedly hostile. My activities as a scout had made me many enemies among the Sioux, and it is not their nature easily to forget old grudges. At the close of the first day I made camp on a tributary of Frenchman's Fork, and built a little fire. The night was bitter cold, and I was so busy keeping warm that I got very little sleep. The next afternoon I began to notice fresh horse tracks and the carcasses of recently killed buffaloes. I knew that I was nearing an Indian camp. It was not policy to ride boldly in among the Indians, as some of them might be inclined to shoot me first and discover later that I was a friend of Spotted Tail. So I hid my horse in a low ravine and crawled up a hill, from whose summit I obtained a good view of the country. When night fell, I rode into camp unobserved. As I entered the camp, I wrapped my blanket, Indian fashion, about my head, so that the redskins would not at once recognize me as a white man. Then I hunted about till I found Spotted Tail's lodge. The old chief was stretched lazily out on a pile of robes as I looked in. He knew who I was and invited me to enter. In the lodge I found Todd Randall, an old white frontiersman, who was Spotted Tail's friend and agent, and who had lived a great many years with the Indians. Randall, who spoke the Sioux jargon perfectly, did the interpreting, and through him I readily communicated to the chief the object of my visit. I said that the warriors and chiefs would greatly please General Sheridan if they would meet him in about 10 sleeps at the old government crossing at the Red Willow. I said that a great chief from far across the water was coming to visit them, and that he was especially anxious to meet the greatest of the Indian chiefs. Spotted Tail replied that he would be very glad to go. He added that on the morrow he would call his men together, and select from them those who were to accompany him. He told me I had acted very wisely in coming first to him, as it was known to him that some of his young men did not like me, and he knew that they had hasty tempers. He expressed himself as pleased that they had not met me outside the village, and I assured him that I was equally pleased that this was so. The chief then called his squaw, who got me something to eat, and I passed the remainder of the night in his lodge. Having informed the old man that this was no ordinary occasion, and that he would be expected to do the job upright, I returned to the post. When the day set for the Grand Duke's arrival came, there was a brave array at the station to meet him. Captain Hayes and myself had 5 or 6 ambulances to carry his party. Captain Egan was on hand with a company of cavalry and 20 extra saddle horses, and the whole population of the place was gathered to see the great man from Russia. The train came in, and from it stepped General Sheridan. A fine figure of a man was towering above him. This was the visitor. I was presented to the Grand Duke as Buffalo Bill, the man who would have charge of the hunt. I immediately ordered up the saddle horse I had selected for the nobleman, also a fine horse for General Sheridan. Both men decided to ride for a few miles before they took seats in the ambulances. When the whole party was mounted, they started south, Texas Jack acting as guide until such time as I could overtake them. The Grand Duke was very much interested in the whole proceeding, particularly in the Indians. It was noticed that he cast frequent and admiring glances at a handsome red-shined maiden, who accompanied old Spotted Tail's daughter. When we made camp, my titled guest plied me with questions about buffaloes and how to kill them. He wanted to know whether a gun or a pistol was the proper weapon, and whether I would be sure to supply him with a horse that was trained in buffalo hunting. I told him that I would give him Buckskin Joe, the best buffalo horse in the country, and that all he would need to do would be to mount the animal and fire away every time he saw a buffalo. At 9 o'clock in the morning we were all galloping over the prairies in search of big game. I waited till everyone was ready, and then led the party over a little knoll that hid the herd from view. In a few minutes we were among the buffaloes. Alexis first chose to use his pistol. He sent 6 shots in rapid succession after one bull, at a distance of only 20 feet, but he fired wildly, and did no damage whatever. I rode up to his side, and, his pistol having been emptied, gave him mine. He seized it and fired 6 more shots, but not a buffalo fell. I saw that he was pretty sure to come home empty-handed, if he continued this sort of pistol practice. So I gave him my old Lucretia, and told him to urge his horse close to the buffaloes, and not to shoot till I gave him the word. At the same time I gave Buckskin Joe a cut with my whip, which sent him at a furious gallop to within 10 feet of one of the biggest bulls in the herd. "Now is your time," I shouted to Alexis. He fired, and down went the buffalo. Then, to my amazement, he dropped his gun, waved his hat in the air, and began talking to members of his suite in his native tongue, which I of course was totally unable to understand. Old Buckskin Joe was standing behind the horse that I was riding, apparently quite as much astonished as I was at the singular conduct of a man he had accepted in good faith as a buffalo hunter. There was no more hunting for the Grand Duke just then. The pride of his achievement had paralyzed any further activity, as a Nimrod in him. Presently General Sheridan came riding up, and the ambulances were gathered round. Soon corks were popping, and champagne was flowing in honor of the Grand Duke Alexis and his first buffalo. Many of the newspapers which printed accounts of the hunt said that I had shot the buffalo for the Grand Duke. Others asserted that I held the buffalo, while the Grand Duke shot him. But the facts are just as I have related them. It was evident to all of us that there could be a little more sport for that day. At the request of General Sheridan, I guided the Russians back to camp. Several of the others in the party decided to indulge in a little hunt on their own account, and presently we saw them galloping madly over the prairie in all directions, with terrified buffaloes flying before them. As we were crossing a stream on our way back to camp, we ran into a small band that had been frightened by some of these hunters. They came sweeping across our path, not more than 30 feet away, and as they passed, Alexis raised his pistol and fired generally into the herd. A buffalo cow fell. It was either an extraordinary shot or a scratch, probably the latter. The Duke was as much astonished as any of us at the result, but we gave him 3 rousing cheers, and when the ambulance came up we had a second round of champagne in honor of the prowess of our distinguished fellow hunter. I began to hope that he would keep right on killing buffaloes all the afternoon, for it was apparent that every time he dropped an animal a basket of champagne was to be opened. And in those days on the plains champagne was not a drink that could be indulged in very often. I took care of the hides and heads of the buffaloes the Grand Duke had shot, as he wanted them all preserved as souvenirs of his hunt, which he was now enjoying immensely. I also cut the choice meat from the cow that he had killed and brought it into camp. At supper he had the pleasure of dining on buffalo meat, which he himself had provided. 8 buffaloes were killed by Alexis during the 3 days we remained in camp. He spent most of his time in the saddle, and soon became really accomplished. After he had satisfied himself as to his own ability as a buffalo killer, he expressed a desire to see how the Indians hunted them. He had never seen bows and arrows used in the pursuit of game. Spotted Tail, who had joined the hunt according to his promise, picked out some of his best hunters, and when Alexis joined them directed them to surround the herd. They were armed with bows and arrows and lances. I told the Grand Duke to follow one particularly skillful brave, whose name was Two Lance, who had a reputation for being able to drive an arrow clear through the body of a bull. The Indian proved equal to his fame. He hauled alongside of an animal, and, bending his powerful bow, let fly an arrow, which passed directly through the bulky carcass of a galloping brute, who fell dead instantly. The arrow, at the Grand Duke's request, was given to him as a souvenir, which he doubtless often exhibited as proof of his story, when some of his European friends proved a little bit skeptical of his yarns of the Western Plains. When the visitor had had enough of buffalo hunting, orders were given to return to the railroad. The conveyance provided for Alexis and General Sheridan was an old-fashioned Irish dog cart, drawn by 4 spirited cavalry horses. The driver was old Bill Reed, an overland stage driver, and our wagon master. The Grand Duke vastly admired the manner in which he handled the reins. On the way over, General Sheridan told his guest that I too was a stage driver, and Alexis expressed a desire to see me drive. "Cody," called the general, "come back here and exchange places with Reed. The Grand Duke wants you to drive for a while." In a few minutes I had the reins, and we were racing across the prairie. We jogged along steadily enough, despite a pretty rapid pace, and this did not suit General Sheridan at all. "Shake him up a little, Bill," he told me as we were approaching Medicine Creek. "Show us some old-time stage driving." I gave the horses a sounding crack with the whip, and they jumped into their work with a real interest. The load was light and their pace increased with every second. Soon they were fairly flying over the ground, and I had all I could do to maintain any control over them. At last we reached a steep hill, or divide, the further side of which sloped down to the creek. There was no brake on the wagon, and the four horses were not in the least inclined to hold back, appearing to be wholly unconcerned as to what might happen. It was impossible to restrain them. My work was cut out for me in keeping them on the track. So I let them set their own pace down the hill. The wagon bounded and rebounded from the bumps in the road, and my two distinguished passengers had to keep very busy holding their seats. However, when they saw that the horses were being kept in the road, they assumed an appearance of enjoying themselves. I was unable to slacken the pace of the horses until they dashed into the camp, where we were to obtain a relay. There I succeeded in checking them. Illustration: Stagecoach driving was full of hair-raising adventures. The Grand Duke and the General said they had got a lot of enjoyment out of the ride, but I noticed that thereafter they were perfectly willing to travel at an easier pace. When we arrived at North Platte, the Grand Duke invited me into his car, and there, over a few bottles of champagne, we went over all the details of the hunt. He said the trip was one which he would never forget, and professed himself as wholly unable to thank me for my part in it. As I was leaving the car, one of his suite approached me, and, extending a big roll of greenbacks, begged me to accept it as a slight token of the Grand Duke's appreciation of my services. I told him I could take nothing for what I had done. He then handed me a small jewel box, which I slipped into my pocket without examining, and asked if I would not also accept the magnificent fur overcoat, which Alexis had worn on the hunt. I had frequently admired this coat, which was made of many fine Russian furs. I was glad to receive it, as a remembrance from one of the most agreeable men I had ever guided on a hunting expedition. After leaving us, Alexis telegraphed to the most famous of New York jewelers, and had made for me a wonderful set of sleeve links and a scarf pin, studded with diamonds and rubies, each piece in the form of a buffalo head, as large as a silver half dollar. Reporters who accompanied the expedition telegraphed the story of this order to their New York newspapers. When later I arrived in New York, after this present had been given me, some of the papers said that Buffalo Bill had come to New York to buy a shirt on which to wear the jewelry given him by the Grand Duke Alexis. Shortly after this, General Ord, who had accompanied the hunting party, rode over with me to Fort McPherson. On the way he asked me how I would like to have a commission in the regular army. General Sheridan, he said, had suggested that I ought to have a commission, and the matter could be arranged if I desired it. I thanked the general, and asked him to thank General Sheridan. But though a commission was a tempting prize, I preferred to remain in the position I was holding. He said that if at any time I felt that I wanted a commission, I only needed to ask for it, and it would be given to me. All I looked forward to was the life of the plains. It was enough for me to be in the saddle, trusting each day to find some new adventure. Army life would mean a great deal of routine, and routine was something I could not endure. So, giving up forever any hope of wearing an officer's shoulder straps, I was about to turn back to the prairies, to see what new opportunities for excitement offered, when a strange new call came to me. General J.J. Reynolds, who had just arrived at Fort McPherson with the 3rd Cavalry, called me into the office one day, and told me that he had a letter, railroad tickets, and $500 for me. Furthermore, he informed me that a 30 days leave of absence was awaiting me whenever I wanted to take it. All this was the doing of the Millionaire's Hunting Party, headed by James Gordon Bennett and the Jeromes, which I had guided the year before. I was, in short, invited to visit my former charges in New York, and provided by them with money and mileage, and leisure for the trip.